Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patty LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okay, so what's funny is when I've told people that we'll be covering South Pacific, I would say that the general response that I get from them is likened unto a child who's been told that they need to go visit their great grandma's house.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Do you know what I mean?
I actually do.
That feeling of, oh, but it smells weird and she has really strange rules. Like, do we have to? My great grandma, she lived through the Depression and everything and had very strict rules about toilet paper to the point where she would unroll the entire roll of toilet paper and take a marker and mark every three squares so that you knew you could only rip off three squares at a time.
That does not sound fun.
And if she went in and there had been, you know,
a breach.
Right, a breach of trust in the toilet paper, there were problems. I also remember in the basement there were these really old bottles of ketchup in her, like, food storage that had turned black. They were no longer red. And I'm pretty sure my aunt and uncle or something were like, hey, Grandma, maybe it's, you know, time to throw out these ketchup
She's
bottles.
Like, oh, they're fine.
Exactly.
It's fine. It's a little tangier. Good.
And I wonder if that's how a lot of people feel about South Pacific. Like, is it a black ketchup bottle at this point that we should just throw away and not have anymore?
So it's funny that you would say that it's like a visit to your great-grandmother's, because that's a little bit what my response to it was when I got asked to do it. I mean, just sort of way underneath.
Sure. After all the gratitude.
Of course. Hashtag blessed. But then, oh, God. And so I actually figured it out. And I talked to my cast about it on the first day, because what I figured out was that I had seen productions of it. And first of all, I have to establish that I maybe err on the side of being a slightly more immature theater goer, just in general. I find myself getting bored easily. Mm-hmm. So how I direct is based off of that tendency to get bored. In addition to that, here's what I figured out. I realized that it was a play.
Yeah.
And when I realized that it was a play, my whole approach and thought about it changed. Because in my opinion, it may be one of the most beautiful scores ever written.
No doubt.
But the songs are an extension of the scenes, an extension of the characters. They are not big spectacle numbers. They are not,
mm-hmm. You know. Showbiz.
Yeah, it's not that at all. And each song comes out of a moment, usually of intimacy. So when I started thinking of it like that, it still holds as, like, something that is one of my most favorite directing experiences ever. I know.
That's so cool.
So it completely flipped.
Well, I'm excited to talk about it. So let's get to it.
Yay!
Welcome, everybody, to a musical theater podcast where we discuss the cultural and emotional impact of some of our favorite musicals in theater history. My name is Jeffrey Scott Parsons. You can call me Jeff. Today we're talking South Pacific, and my guest is Kirsten Chandler, who is a woman, friend, mother, director, actor, dog owner. What am I missing?
Foodie. Baker.
What's your go-to? Because, you know, my culture, you say I love you by making cookies. I mean, that's just how it is.
Well, you know, I understand that. And I think that I delve into many baked goods. I would say that, you know, latest experiment would be with breads.
Oh,
which is, I know, I've
advanced.
I'm actually like, I'm looking into yeast. It's like the more complicated thing to do, but I'm taking it on.
That's exciting.
But yeah, you know, cookies are, that's a thing for me.
Yeah.
Around the holidays.
Nice. I'm impressed by the bread.
Thank you.
And like, do you have a bread maker?
No.
Or you're doing
like,
the...
Yes, I have a bread maker. It's my oven.
Yeah.
Yes. I should try the whole Instant Pot thing
because
that's like interesting that people throw a bunch of things in the pot and
then
it turns into bread.
Yeah.
And I haven't tried that yet.
I'm kind of at the point where I have so many... I have too many gadgets in the kitchen. I have two waffle makers, one that's a Belgian waffle maker, one that's a heart-shaped waffle maker just for Valentine's Day. You know, like it's reached a point where... There's too much. There's too much in that kitchen.
Well, you know what? You can use them all if you have lots of people over.
Fair enough.
Because one takes a long time.
Good point.
So you can just, you know, like smack them all down and...
Waffle bar at Jeff's house.
Completely.
What were we talking about? South Pacific.
South Pacific.
have you ever played Nelly Forbush? Because I feel like that would have been a thing for you, right?
That's nice of you to say. No, I never did. And when I was a performer, I was also a... somewhat less mature human being. Yes.
Aren't we
and
all?
So, well, you know, but some of us had more like, you know, the things that interested me were just very, I had blinders on. So I think Nelly Forbush fell outside of what I considered interesting, which, you know, what a mistake. Especially now I look back on so many of those classic characters and go, why didn't I do that? Why wasn't I interested in that?
But I also think we've come around to recognizing there's more to these...
Absolutely.
These chestnuts, these war horses, besides there's nothing like a dame.
Correct.
You know?
Yeah.
Because for the longest time, that's what I thought South Pacific was. It was just a bunch of sailors talking about women.
Yes.
And then you go and see it and you're like, wait, the first 20 minutes is two people. And then all of a sudden your expectations are not met.
The approach is like it's shtick almost. Mm. And it's a huge mistake. There's some real stuff going on. Well, you know, one of the most interesting things is at the end of the show when they're shipping out, at the end of this whole long show where really they're just waiting on this island to be told the next step as Marines.
In war.
Yeah. And in the original, I believe, there's a reprise of Honey Bun.
Yes.
And it's very sort of like jaunty and fun. Well, when I directed it, we reexamined that moment because... This is the moment they ship out. Here's an interesting thing. When we got our costume plot, the Marines uniforms for when they ship out were like, one of them had a starfish on it and a netting and you know, it's like,
Wow.
But you can see how the approach was that this wasn't a dire, very sobering moment for these men about to ship out. So we changed the music to just be very sort of stark and military in that moment so that you looked at this song that was really funny earlier in the act and it turns very solemn. The Lincoln Center version did this something very similar. And I looked at it and went, oh, my God, they looked at that, too, and said, this isn't the right feeling for this moment. So it's interesting, you know, I think that some companies in the past maybe especially have approached it more, I guess, you know, musical comedy,
you know, exactly.
Rather than real stuff going on and like a play where
but
real
don't you
are
think
happening.
We're kind of guilty of doing that with most Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Maybe.
And this is the first Rodgers and Hammerstein, the first Iron Age musical that we're covering on the podcast.
Oh, cool.
Which is fun.
Oh, I'm honored
to
be part of it.
We're not going to do the deep dive into their history because we'll probably save that for Oklahoma.
Got it.
But
that's good because I'll mess up. I'll say something wrong.
But it's true. We kind of do this to all of their shows where it's, oh, it's fluff. It's R&H, you know?
Right.
And by the time they come together as a composing team, they've been in this business a long time.
Yes.
Richard Rodgers with Lorenz Hart and Oscar Hammerstein II with Jerome Kern and, you know, countless others. They're at the point where they're not needing to prove anything to anyone.
Right.
In fact, they want to take over musical theater and reign as giants of Broadway. And they do.
As well they should.
As well, right? But there's nothing accidental about what they create.
Yeah.
And somehow we think of it as fluffy. That was not the intention behind these artists.
Correct. And, you know, especially South Pacific's themes dealt with racism at a time when that wasn't, I don't know if anyone had ever put it into a musical.
It's something that he was really interested in for most of his career. When you think about working with Jerome Kern and Showboat,
yes,
he's always kind of looking at racism, specifically the racism coming out of World War II, mm-hmm. was very interesting to him. So, you know, rewinding, we're going to history. World War II ends in like 1945. Mm-hmm. And out of it, a book is written called Stories of the South Pacific.
Tales of the South Pacific.
Thank you. Tales of the South Pacific by James Michener. And it's a collection of 19 short stories. There's no actual through line through the entire book. They're just all of these short stories, right?
Yep.
Talking about his experiences as someone serving in the military.
Correct.
And it wins the Pulitzer Prize. Hollywood passes on it. But it comes across the eyes of Joshua Logan, who is a director, famous director, had worked with Rodgers and Hammerstein on Allegro, which was the musical right before this. So Rodgers and Hammerstein had a huge hit with Oklahoma, a huge hit with Carousel. Then they write Allegro, which is a huge flop. But they really enjoyed working on it with Josh Logan. So he shows R&H this book and says, I think that we should, you know, do something with this.
Yes.
They immediately go to James Michener and are like, can we have this to use? And Michener says, absolutely, Hollywood didn't want it. And he wasn't even an author. He had won a Pulitzer Prize, but he wasn't even a full-time author at that point. He was still an editor working at Macmillan Publishing. Crazy.
Wow.
So, like, no showbiz sense whatsoever with this guy. He agrees to let them musicalize it in exchange for, I think, 1% of box office receipts.
That is correct.
What I think is fascinating about Oscar Hammerstein's connection with this material, and specifically the racism and prejudice found within it, is that his wife, Dorothy, had a sister who was married to a Japanese American. And he worked in New York and was interned in Ellis Island during World War II. Crazy.
That is crazy.
The sister-in-law and the daughter move in with the Hammersteins because her husband is interned at Ellis Island. They take the daughter to a school who is, you know, half Japanese. And the mother asks the principal, I want to make sure that my daughter will be safe here because there is obviously a lot of prejudice going on.
Yeah.
And the school says she's going to have to pay for her antecedents. That was literally the quote. So then they take her out of that school immediately and put her into like a Quaker school because at least she'll be safe there.
Yes.
So this is all happening in Oscar Hammerstein's house. And so it's like fresh in his mind and it's present in the James Michener stories.
And he didn't shy away from it. In fact, there were people who in out-of-town tryouts tried to get him to remove songs like You've Got to Be Carefully Taught. And he said, well, that's our play.
Mm-hmm.
This is the whole point
exactly.
of what I wrote. And so, no, which is great.
Short.
And it stuck to his guns.
Yeah.
They didn't think it was going to be commercial or that it wouldn't play.
It seems like everybody was really allergic to feeling preached to, which is silly because then you've also got like the Ten Commandments and Ben-Hur and kind of all of these pieces of entertainment that actually feel very preachy to me.
Somebody actually, I think one of the reviewers wrote, it felt patronizing or something
like
that. Yeah, like
you're being talked down to. I'm like,
yeah.
Really? This?
But somehow people were ready for it because it was a huge hit and it was reviewed beautifully and mm-hmm. it won the Pulitzer for play. So,
yeah. Do you know that Oscar Hammerstein ended up opening the first adoption agency for international children and biracial children. It was called like Welcome Home or something like that.
Wow. That's super cool.
I mean, I'm not saying he was a perfect man, but he had a pretty high set of ideals that he was putting into practice in both his work and his life. And I got to hand it to him. Like, that's pretty amazing.
It is. It's pretty cool.
So they start musicalizing it. What is funny is that Oscar Hammerstein was really into the whole relationship between Nellie Forbush and Imelda Beck.
Yes.
Right? So you have Nellie Forbush, who's this, you know, cockeyed optimist, southern gal from America, and Imelda Beck, who is a Frenchman living on this island in the South Pacific.
Yes.
And they meet and have this relationship, and Oscar Hammerstein loved writing that one. But he very upfront said that he has no idea what it's like to serve in the military.
Yes.
And had no idea how to write about them.
That's how he came to, I mean, Joshua Logan mm-hmm. was the one who brought that knowledge
exactly.
to the table.
Because he had served as well as had written, what was it, Journey's End? Is that the play?
Yes, I think.
It was like the year before he directed and helped write this play that was also about the military. And so it was a perfect fit. However, R&H being, you know, once again, Titans and Giants of Broadway, they were not going to let Joshua Logan have credit for writing it because no one was going to break up the team of Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Yes.
And it wasn't until much later that they allowed the book to be billed as having been written by Joshua Logan and Oscar Hammerstein.
Second. Right.
But he didn't get any money for it.
No.
Isn't that crazy?
I didn't know that.
Yeah. He only got it in billing.
Wow.
Those guys were
hardcore. But then he directed the movie, didn't he?
Did he direct the movie? Now I'm going to look that
up. Okay, look it
up.
I'm
not sure.
Maybe he got something for that.
Do you like the movie?
No.
Yeah. It's interesting.
I mean, you know, there's things to appreciate about all things,
of course.
Even not so great things, but it's clunky.
It's super clunky. It's got a lot of interesting color. Yeah, you're right. Josh Logan directed the movie.
Boom. Yeah, some of the color changes. It's like random. Suddenly it's like it was shot with a different camera.
Yeah.
I mean, it's completely odd.
At the beginning of Wonderful Guy, when Mitzi Gaynor's just like staring down the lens and just singing straight to camera, and you're like, what is happening? Is she looking into my soul?
I kind of love those things. Like, you can look back at some movies that experimented with things that either became then turned into something or didn't, very much didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But you can go, I appreciate that. You tried something. You went for it. That did not work. I just think that in general, you know, now making a go of it as a director and feeling like I'm improving every single time. But I'm not really interested in safe.
Yeah.
It doesn't interest me. And I think that that's part of what I said earlier is that maybe the productions that I saw of South Pacific were safe.
Mm.
They were, you know, cute.
Sure.
And I just don't think it's a cute show.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much more there to explore. There's so much going on.
It's interesting that safe theater might be the only bad kind of theater because theater in its inception is dangerous.
Yes.
It's happening live. It's different every time. So if it feels safe, then you're like, why am I even here?
Right. But as a director, I just love the idea of making mistakes in trying something that might be a little different. Not different for different sake, because
yes.
I'm greatly reverent of why something was written, and I think that that's really important to take into account. You just can't, I'm not going to put a certain show in post-apocalyptic times
yes.
just because it's new, and of course now it's not new anyway, so
mm-hmm.
P.S. You know what I mean? I love figuring out what was the reason this was written, what are the themes, what's the musical style, what was important here, and not necessarily just throwing it up the same way it's always been thrown up, but
right.
but asking myself the questions. If I didn't know anything about this, what would I do with it? So
that's great.
Yeah,
I love
well,
that.
You know, I'm learning.
In episodes past, I've talked a lot about musicals that were in trouble, and then miraculously, the theater gods smiled and everything worked out.
Right.
In South Pacific, it seems like from the get-go, it was going to be a hit. Everyone knew it was going to be a hit, and it was a hit.
Yeah.
End of story. Like, that doesn't happen very often, but it did in this case.
Yes.
In Los Angeles, around this time, how do you say his name? Ezio?
Ezio.
Ezio Pinza?
Yeah. My dad will kill me if I didn't say it right, because he
was he a big
loves.
Yeah.
He had albums.
Oh, that's
yes,
so cute.
Yeah.
So Ezio Pinza was contracted at the L.A. Civic Glide Opera to do some show. The show falls through. But what they were currently producing was the national tour of Annie Get Your Gun, starring one Mary Martin and produced by
uh-huh.
Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Ah.
So R&H already had a relationship with this Civic Light Opera because they went to go see the show and, you know, talk to Mary. So then the guy in charge says, hey, this show just fell through for Ezio. Do you have anything that might work? Because we have him under contract and we need something for him to do. And they said, actually, he might be perfect for Emile Debeck. And now we need an Nellie Forbush. You know what? Mary Martin, who's doing Annie Get Your Gun, she'll be swell as well. And so it all just like fell into place.
Amazing. It was Kismet.
It was.
But that's another show.
But that's another show. That's a few years later. So everybody signs on. The thing is that opera stars get paid so much money because they don't work very often.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, Broadway performers are doing 8 shows a week. That's not what you do in opera. It's just the material's too crazy. So he was supposed to be getting this huge amount of money. Mary Martin's a huge star, obviously, from Annie Get Your Gun and all of her stuff before that. And she's interesting. Do you like Mary Martin? I'm a big Mary Martin fan.
I love Mary Martin. I just watched, just because I knew I was going to come see you, I decided to watch her again. Mm-hmm. Because I hadn't seen her in a while.
Yeah.
And it just struck me how simple and wonderful and connected she is all the time.
So special.
Yeah. Just, you know, it's sort of like when I watch Jimmy Stewart in cinema and just think, I think he was ahead of his time in his, you know, is utterly real, would be a wonderful actor right now.
Yeah.
If you took his performance as a young man and just flipped it to 2020. Absolutely holds up. And I feel the same way about Mary Martin.
That totally gave me chills. Mary Martin is the Jimmy Stewart of musical theater.
There you go.
It's true.
I'll go with it.
Because their personas are undeniable. There's an element of them to whatever project they do or role they do, to the point where they change the role to be more like them. Mm-hmm. You know, Mary Martin's Annie in Annie Get Your Gun was very different than Merman, and her Dolly in Hello, Dolly was very different than Carol Channing, but brilliant nonetheless because they're so talented and so present and
so organic and also effortless.
You just
like the way
yes.
her voice fell out of her was effortless. And mm-hmm. I'm continually in awe of that.
I guess she met Oscar Hammerstein very early out here in Los Angeles. She sang a song that he wrote, like I think it was like Indian Love Call, because at that point she was still trying to just do like coloratura stuff.
Oh, wow.
And she said, I'm going to sing a song. You may not have heard it before. And he had written it.
Oh.
Isn't that funny? And he liked her. He liked her. He liked her voice. So he introduced her to Jerome Kern. And Jerome Kern said, who was, you know, famous composer, Showboat. Jerome Kern said, there are a lot of sopranos who can sing better than you in terms of the soprano world. So I think you should kind of own your voice and do your own thing. And you're going to be phenomenal. And she did. Nobody sounds like Mary Martin.
Nope.
Unless you're trying to do an impression of Mary Martin.
Correct. I don't even know. Has there been anybody who tries to do an impression of Mary Martin?
I remember on Forbidden Broadway they did, I'm swooping, because she tends to slide a lot.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
Like Julie Andrews. There's a swooping quality there, too.
There is. There's a little glide.
But they're both awesome.
They are. Quans. Okay. So they both sign on. But once again, huge stars, huge salaries. They both decide to take a pay cut in order for the show to happen.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
How great.
They believed in it that much. Mary Martin brought a lot of ideas to Nellie Forbush. I guess one time with her husband, who was also her manager, she was in the shower washing her hair, and she realized no one's ever washed their hair on stage before. And she ran out of, like, the bathroom stark naked and was like, babe.
I've got it.
I've got it. What if I washed my hair on stage? And, of course, she went to the phone and called them right up. And
so she's the reason that every theater that produces South Pacific has to solve that conundrum.
Yep.
Thank you, Mary Martin.
Thanks, Mary Martin. She would wash her hair in the show, mm-hmm. and then, but you didn't get out all of the soap there on stage because there's only so much water you can use.
Right.
So then you'd go back to the dressing room, wash it again. And so that's probably turns into 20 times a week.
Yeah.
And then she performed
it for... That's an overwashed head.
I mean, she better have got some hot oil treatments because can you imagine the split ends over 7 years?
Right. Seriously. And then sidebar, you know, oftentimes when you produce South Pacific, as was the case when I directed it, mm-hmm. our actress had hair that would not work for that
time period.
Oh, right.
So, of course.
So she's in a wig. And then you have to wig... the shampooing.
Oh,
so
you have
two wigs.
You have a double wig. You have
of
one the
course.
Shampoo.
Yeah,
I didn't even think about that.
I know,
that.
And it was great. Our wig person was tremendous. His name is Peter. And he just, it just looked seamless. You absolutely couldn't tell that it wasn't her hair.
Wow.
Either wig. It was fantastic.
That's fantastic.
But she washed a wig. Awesome. That was a very clean wig.
That's a squeaky, you could eat off that wig.
I have a feeling it's probably been retired. She's in a closet somewhere. She's done.
They bring her out for like the before and after in Steel Magnolias or something.
Right. Yeah, maybe she'll find a new life as Frumacera or something, you know, like something crazy. But yeah.
Oh, okay. I do want to read one quote that, you know, Helen Hayes,
yes,
the famous actress.
Helen Hayes.
Yeah, how to
Candle Shoe. Did you ever see that movie?
Of course, with the old Disney movie?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's one of our family favorites. We always yank it out.
I love those like weird old, that period in Disney.
Jodie Foster, yes, and Helen Hayes.
And there's like,
she's wonderful.
There's like jewels, aren't there?
Oh, yeah, there's a hidden treasure.
Yeah.
What more could you want?
I love hidden treasure stores.
Foster, Hayes, treasure.
Can we discuss that Jodie Foster was in both Freaky Friday and Taxi Driver in the same
year?
Are you kidding me? Retire.
That I know.
So famous Helen Hayes wrote something called The 10 Most Memorable Stage Performances She Had Ever Seen.
Oh.
And she included, you know, Olivier as Oedipus Brando in Streetcar, Lorette Taylor in Glass Menagerie. And then she fully admitted that in this conversation, you're not supposed to bring up musical comedy because, you know, because it's not serious enough, but that she could not help herself. Quote, "You cannot analyze Mary Martin's charm any more than you can analyze sunshine.
Wow.
But you can say that she radiates more perfection and sheer joy per cubic foot of actress than any else in recent history."
Wow.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yes.
What a great compliment.
Unbelievable.
And yet also very accurate, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so South Pacific, the show starts with, well, a great overture, first of all, which, ooh, I found out something really interesting. Richard Rodgers was so intent on getting the songs right that he had people help him with, you know, orchestrations and underscoring. The underscoring woman was named Trudy. And she worked with him her entire career.
Oh.
And he was actually kind of intimidated by her and was one of the reasons why he continually worked with her.
Interesting.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah, so that is cool.
I think she came onto the team because of Agnes DeMille. She played in ballet classes. And so much of what we probably think of as these scores is from Trudy.
That is really interesting.
So cool.
I love it.
But the show starts after that beautiful overture with the two cutest kids you've ever seen in your life.
Yes.
And they are singing Dites Moi. Now, I am not a French expert at all, but this means tell me, pourquoi,
why life is beautiful.
Yeah, why life is beautiful. Tell me why life is gay. Is it because you love me? Something like that.
It must be because you love me.
It must, yeah, okay, yeah. That sounds right.
And it's very sweet.
There's something there that's kind of setting the tone. It's not just about having cute kids. They're telling us the message,
yes,
right from the get-go.
Yes, that's very true.
Love is
love
the most
important.
Love
will conquer all. Let's hope.
And they live in this beautiful place in the South Pacific, this house kind of on a hill that overlooks the gorgeous ocean.
He owns a plantation.
And by plantation, I mean, I have my American views of what plantations are. What are they in the South Pacific? Do you have...
More islandy.
Do you have...
I don't know.
But, like, do they have servants, like, harvesting
yes.
pineapples? Like,
well,
is that kind
of
a thing?
Well, I don't know if it goes there, but he does have servants.
Okay,
yeah. In fact, the first one makes his appearance
That's
right
true.
After Dites Moi.
That is true. I just didn't know if it was more of, like, a lifestyle or an actual business where they're growing things. Bamboo. I don't know.
Well, he takes great pride in his plantation. He's taking her around. I would guess that he doesn't do very much of it himself, so he
yeah.
must have workers.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
And it's a gorgeous place. It's owned by this dude, Emile de Bec. And we don't know yet, but these two children are his.
Yes.
And they are mixed race. He is French, and he had been married to a Polynesian woman. And they had these two children. Did she pass away?
Yes.
Okay.
The man has lived.
The man.
Suffice it to say.
He's He's been around the block. The other the other day I decided to watch, like, sit down and watch a high school production of South Pacific on YouTube. And do you know what? The kid playing Emile Debeck had a gorgeous voice, but but also had, like, the baby powder in his hair because he's supposed to be middle aged.
Yeah, that's the joy of high school theater.
Love it so much. So he's on a date with Nellie Forbush, who's our
cockeyed
sparrow.
Optimist.
Yeah, cockeyed optimist. I think it's really interesting that she begins the show describing herself as a cockeyed optimist.
Yes.
Because she's green. She comes from a simple life and with a lot of sameness around her. And so nothing has really kind of bumped up to disrupt any of that optimism. But we immediately like her.
She's fantastic. She's adorable.
The truest heart you could want.
Yeah.
And he adores her as well.
Yep.
In fact, he's fully in love and is ready for her to kind of move in and play house. Like, this is it.
Yeah, because, you know, when you see someone across a crowded room,
never
let her go.
You just never let her
go.
Out of this, they have these twin soliloquies.
Yes.
This is interesting because
I bet you know the same thing that I know about this.
That Mary Martin didn't want to sing with Itziar
Finza? Right, because she didn't think she could compete.
Yeah, I mean, he has that huge voice, right? And she's like, I'm Mary Martin, no.
Yeah, we're not going to sing together. It's an interesting thing because, now there is a moment, it's one of the many reprises of Some Enchanted Evening because they just keep bringing that sucker back.
Man, there's a lot of reprises.
It's like, this is our
in
hit.
This show.
Yeah, they do. Well, of course, they had many hits. Every single song is so tremendous that you cannot believe that they all were in one show.
Yeah.
You just can't believe it. But, I want to say that they do sing together briefly, and it's in front of the shower. I could be wrong. Yeah.
These soliloquies are really beautiful, though. And And the music is, like, swelling to this huge finale, and all they're doing is, like, sitting and enjoying a cocktail.
Yep.
Kind of cool.
Yeah.
And I think that is when I had the same realization that you've had about this show, where you're like, this is a drama. This is a musical drama.
And you can see how the music is swelling. There's no singing. There's this one moment where all they're doing is looking at each other. And I think in the script it says they are falling in love in this moment.
Mm.
So if you don't approach it as a real moment between two actors, between two characters, with something happening that's as huge and sweeping as falling in love, you can see how someone would be like, could somebody get to There's Nothing Like a Dame?
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
TikTok.
Yeah. But how wonderful, like you said, that they would actually have this moment where there's the only thing going on is falling in love, which is one of the most grand emotions that we can experience here on Earth. You know what I mean?
For sure.
It's such a neat moment. Absolutely love it.
And these are things that Rodgers and Hammerstein had been flirting with since the beginning of their career. You know, beginning a show like Oklahoma with just the old lady on the porch instead of the showgirls that all of the other musicals had, you know, been doing. They've been pushing the envelope more and more in terms of what does a musical look like, sound like, and tackle in terms of subject matter. And this is, I think, probably the one where you see them owning it.
Yes.
Regardless of whether you think it's successful or not, probably owning it the most.
Yeah. How daring to start a musical like this.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it's the crux of the two central characters. But then to open up to where they are and who's around them is an interesting way of starting the show instead of the other way around.
And I also think that we need to put ourselves back into 1949 and add a little context. So World War II affected everybody in this country to a profound, extent. You fast forward 4 years, only 4 years later, there's a musical about World War II coming to Broadway,
right,
written by Rodgers and Hammerstein. When has that kind of turnaround ever existed in any of our current art forms? The most that I can think of is maybe like The Hurt Locker. Or like a Catherine Bigelow film that's about the Afghanistan, Zero Dark Thirty. Something like that where people are like, wow, we're already making a movie about this?
Right.
You know, like, has enough time passed? So it would have been, I think, incredibly disrespectful 4 years after this war to begin a show with Nothing Like a Dame.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And I'm wrong.
We're not prepared for that.
That's quick turnaround.
It is.
To address the things that were going on. when we open up on the Marines and Seabees and they're with Bloody Mary, we come to find out that they really are. The whole show is they're just stationed and waiting.
Waiting. The endless waiting. That's what James Michener
talks
about.
Endless waiting, yes. And so, you know, a lot of his, Michener's observations came from having the time to observe around him, to observe the character that became Bloody Mary. Just he'd never seen anybody like her.
Right.
And the study of her in his writing is really fascinating. But anyway, I digress.
No. Now, I have not served in the military. The closest that I have to a military experience is my mission for the church. Because there is kind of like an army type feel. There's, you know, very strict rules. You're up at 6 a.m.,
Yeah.
And also, I was a Spanish-speaking missionary, so I was in a culture that was not mine.
So I didn't know that. That's very cool.
So that whole idea of looking at, and it's problematic for sure, but to look at another culture and almost objectify it because it's so novel. You've never experienced people like this. You've never experienced customs like this. And you're like, this is so entertaining and interesting. And I'm vanilla and I am so used to all of my traditions. Look at all of these ones. I'm having the time of my life.
Yes.
And that is certainly what I'm getting, you know, from these Seabees who are experiencing the Polynesian lifestyle and particularly Bloody Mary.
Yes. They approach them like novelties. And then what was sad was that when it wasn't convenient anymore, they get shooed away.
Yes.
And it's their native land.
Right.
So you're seeing all of that in South Pacific. And it's, I think that the tone has changed as we've matured as socially conscious people to actually have this conversation about what was really going on here.
Yeah.
It's not just like, oh, yay, younger than springtime. And what's going on this island?
So then how do you show that without it becoming objectification? You know, how do you show that without showing some offensive stereotype?
Right.
You know,
well,
first, you
cast well.
Yeah.
So that's important. Casting with...
with integrity.
Integrity, absolutely. Across the boards, that's important. But I guess that is a central question about a show like South Pacific, which was in so many ways ahead of its time in wanting to deal with the issues of racism and asking tough questions of the audience.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I wanted to just mention was that, you know, there are some people who call South Pacific that racist musical or that racist play. And I feel like that is confused way of thinking. Yes, there's a racist in South Pacific, namely Nellie, which is
and probably
shocking.
probably more than her.
Yes, and we talked about that too. Yeah, but the I guess that I would say the most central and the glaring racism comes from Nellie, and
which is insane to make someone as likable as your leading lady.
Very, very insane because you love her so much, and we spend all of the first act loving her, and then at the very end of the first act, she realizes that he was married to a Polynesian and that his children are mixed race and that they're his children, and she can't handle it. And she is faced with her own racism, and she doesn't like that one bit.
Right.
And, so it's really interesting.
It's challenging to her optimism, her outlook that she's always, you know, professed. And I think that that is –
She tries to justify it, too, in the second act. She's – this – you don't understand. Like, this is
part of me, and, you know, I think we all – run into that, especially as, like you said, as we become more socially aware and socially conscious, there are things that are a part of us we didn't even know were a part of us. We either have to come up against something that brings them up or they have to be pointed out.
Yes.
And we have to be humble enough to go, yeah, you're right.
And to Nellie's credit, she reexamines her racism and she chooses love.
Mm-hmm.
So she learns, and how brave that we had a character, a heroine, the heroine of our piece, who has a flaw and then faces her flaw and then decides that she is going to grow from this experience and not be that limited person.
It's an arc that Anna doesn't have in King and I.
Yeah.
You know?
That's true.
Which is after South Pacific. So, like, it's a brave piece. I really like it.
It's super brave and flawed, yes. But,
yes.
You know, I guess it brings up that bigger question of how do we go back, and I don't know if you've had this experience where, like, even you look at a movie from 20 years ago or a TV show or whenever, you go, oh, Like, you know, because we're so much more aware now than we were 20 years ago of what might be considered offensive or what definitely is offensive. And we didn't see it that way 20 years ago and how we're all awakening to a different way of thinking.
There was, so, there was a span there for a while where I was doing productions of White Christmas every Christmas.
Oh, sure.
And I was playing, you know, Phil Davis, who's like the ladies' man. And I don't know, you know, he's always got a girl on each, you know, arm and, and flirting with everybody, sometimes inappropriately. And in between the two Christmases, the two holiday seasons, the whole Weinstein thing happens. And I come back to White Christmas and all of a sudden I'm rehearsing this piece that I've done years. And I'm like, ugh. every yes. choice that I'm making, I'm like, oh, that's gross. Should I do that? Like, is that okay? You know? Completely different experience but based on all of the realizations that I had about the experiences of women and, and how they're specifically portrayed in not only theater but just in media in general.
And that brings up that point of, like, how do we produce in so many ways a beautiful breakthrough piece of theater that may be flawed in places? How do we depict those moments? Do we soft pedal them? I don't pretend to know the answer. Sometimes I feel like
it needs a conversation. That's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. But you're also examining a time period. For example, let's just take the Seabees and Marines with Bloody Mary, that they treated her as a novelty and then shooed her aside when she wasn't convenient. If you look at it, that can be a growth experience. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
I don't know
absolutely.
If I'm saying it right, but
No, I totally get that.
Yeah.
Oh, I definitely want to say also that on the date at the plantation, Emile, you know, sings Some Enchanted Evening, kind of, which someone sings Some Enchanted Evening to you, you fall in love.
Yeah, you better.
Do you know that Andrew Lloyd Webber said that all he ever wanted to do in his career was write a song as good as Some Enchanted Evening?
And he's still trying. I didn't say that on a musical theater broadcast.
but I think he would agree with you, though, because that's how perfect Some Enchanted Evening was to him.
Yes, I agree. It may be one of the best love songs ever, ever written.
I mean,
written.
My gosh. Yeah. But after that, he has a confession to her. Now, this is kind of telling because he doesn't confess that he was married to a Polynesian woman.
Right.
He instead confesses the thing that he thought was actually going to ruin things between him and Nellie, which is that he's killed someone.
Yes.
And he brings it up a lot.
Yeah.
And she
just wraps her brain around that.
And she's able to wrap her brain around that one. But he brings it up because he's afraid that
it'll be a deal breaker.
So he doesn't even think about the children being possible deal breaker.
Right. Good for him.
Yeah. Now, this, of course, leads me to a little game that I want to play with you called Would You Rather?
Oh, good God.
Now, would you rather, which you're already married to the Stan Chandler.
Yes.
But if you were not, would you rather marry a murderer, someone who's convicted of murder?
Okay.
Marry a drug addict or marry a sex offender?
Oh, good God.
It's a fun game of would you rather.
I would think a drug addict.
Really? That's actually, I think, my deal breaker.
Sex offender isn't your deal breaker?
Technically, you could pee on the side of the highway and be a sex offender.
Well, that's true. If you think about the gradient.
There is a gradient.
Yes, there's a gradient. I guess I'd have to know what the crime was.
Yeah.
Now, you know, Emile had a very good reason for killing the person
exactly.
that he did. So, you know, there's context is key.
Context is
very
key.
But if I'm just saying, oh, you killed somebody, you offended someone sexually, or you're a drug addict, I feel like, okay, so you're hurting others versus hurting yourself.
Fair enough.
And so if, like, the drug addict, maybe we could get them to rehab.
Can you imagine that conversation? I know I just sang Some Enchanted Evening, but I have to tell you something. I'm a registered sex offender. And you're like, I'm just putting it out there. Did you happen to pee on the side of the highway?
Just hoping.
I'm just putting.
Because I heard.
I heard that
could
be
a
thing. Context clues are everything when it comes to relationships.
Yes.
Back to South Pacific. We go to the beach and we meet the sailors. We meet Bloody Mary, who's a local. She sells
human
heads.
All sorts of things, yes. Grass skirts.
Uh-huh. She's an entrepreneur, let's be honest, right? She's a businesswoman.
Yes.
She's also being really heavily taken advantage of by the military.
Yes.
Does she live there or does she live on Bali High? That's my question.
She lives on Bali High.
Okay. So Bali High is an island across from where they are. You can barely see it. It's kind of a mystical place.
Yes.
You need a boat to get there. Particularly one of the CBs by the name of Luther Billis, mm-hmm. who's also has kind of created the side hustle of doing laundry.
He's a side
hustler. Yeah, yes. Creating grass skirts.
However he can make money, he's like smuggling cigarettes for all the
right.
soldiers and like, yeah, he's...
And he's obsessed with getting over to Bali High. He says because there's this pig ceremony that he really wants to watch, but it's because he keeps hearing...
He wants the...
The bracelet, the, right?
Yeah, the boar's head bracelet.
The boar's tooth bracelet.
Yeah.
But also, you realize later that it's because he hears that like girls dance with their tops off at the ceremony and there's like possible orgy type things mm-hmm. happening.
Yes.
So that's like the real reason that he
yeah.
wants to go. But he really wants to go to Bali High, but he can't get a boat to go over there because you have to be a commander. Enter Lieutenant Cable, who is new to the island, and he does have clearance.
Mm-hmm.
Lieutenant Cable, he's a handsome fella.
Usually.
Yeah. Do you know what's interesting is instead of like in Oklahoma or in Carousel where you had the funny couple and the romantic couple, in this show you have two romantic couples.
Yeah.
You have Emile DeBeck and Natalie Forbush and then Leah and Cable. You have two different romances happening at the same time that
True.
Are both very serious.
Yes.
So Cable has a girl from back home, right? And sometimes they have that song, sometimes they don't. When I did the show, we did not do that number.
Which one?
My girl from back home.
Oh, we didn't either.
Yeah.
I guess it's not part of the licensing.
Okay.
Currently.
It's in the movie and it was in the revival, but I didn't know if it was in, it's probably.
Not in our version.
Okay. Nellie, as the nurse, has come back to her, you know, friends and has decided to give up. Emile DeBeck. Maybe it's just not a good idea. Things are moving too fast. There's this whole murder thing.
Like, never good.
Yeah. I'm just going to wash that man right out of my hair. Cue washing your hair. I have a really funny story real fast.
Okay.
So I did a, I did a benefit with Mitzi Gaynor.
Oh.
Right?
Awesome.
This was just like a few years ago. And we shared a microphone. We shared like a body mic. And she did her number, and then she would go off stage, and I would meet her over there, and she would take it off, and the sound guy would put it on me. And then after the following number, then I would go out there.
Okay.
So we do the dress rehearsal. She sings Wash That Man Right Out of My Hair. She's like, you know, holding herself up at the piano. Just great. Mitzi Gaynor, by the way, star of the South Pacific, the film.
The film, yes.
So the night of the performance, we're doing it, and... You know, the boom chuck starts for Wash That Man, and she turns to the audience and goes, you all are going to love this. And she reaches behind the piano and grabs shaving cream and puts it in her hair and starts, like, washing her hair on stage with this shaving cream. I'm off stage with the sound guy who is freaking out.
Of course. She didn't tell anybody she was going to do this.
She didn't tell anybody. And he's like, my microphone, my microphone. Which leads me to my question. What do you do with sound? Does she take off the microphone?
No.
How do you not get the microphone wet?
Well, it's tricky. As I recall, she would lean her head back.
Okay.
So if her mic was, you know, positioned correctly, she could lean her head back and just let the water hit.
Rather
than come forward.
Mm-hmm.
And that was key. I seem to recall that they were like, please don't. Tip forward because then we've got a problem.
Oh, that makes sense.
So it's doable, but it's tricky.
It is tricky.
The other thing was, P.S., getting warm water to come through the unit was a challenge because...
Just like...
right. So the poor girl was like, can we please be... Yeah. So it had to be of a certain temperature so that she didn't freeze.
Oh, my heavens.
I know. It's a lot of challenges. Thanks, Murray Martin.
Yeah, good job, Mayor.
Appreciate it.
Do you know that... Richard Rodgers was really upset because they thought that this number was going to be, you know, smash bang home run. And when they started performing it, like, it was getting tepid applause at best. And they're like, how is this even possible? Like, she's washing her hair. And then someone told him, everybody is talking during the song to decide whether or not Mary Martin's actually washing her hair. So then they added a verse of her singing the song before even getting in the shower so that people would listen to the song
that
and then enjoy
brilliant.
The
yeah.
shampooing.
Yeah.
Interesting stuff. So she washes that man, but not super great, because then Emile de Bac comes back and sings another reprise of Some Enchanted Evening, and then she's in for realsies.
Yes. I believe that's the scene where she says, I need to ask you about this. I need more details.
Oh, right, right, right.
And so then he gives them to her. And it certainly seems like it was a justifiable homicide.
It was this bad guy who
came to the village and was like bullying people and hurting people and saying, you know, and so then, he stood up to him.
And then they got in a fight, and
he does say that he came at him or something like that, but he defends himself, but actually like strangles him.
Wow.
I think he.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And he says, I would do it again, I think, to defend my.
Ooh, this is good
stuff. I could be South Pacific Police. Don't come after me.
I think you're fine.
Okay. I think I'm close to right. Like, I'd have to have the script right in front of me.
I think I remember seeing the South Pacific Police in my great-grandma's basement.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, good. Hopefully they're busy with the ketchup. They don't need to come after
me. No worries.
Good.
So Nellie's, she's good with it based on that whole thing.
And that's when she sings one of my favorites, I'm in Love with a Wonderful Guy.
Oh, so great.
Yes, and which originally they called I'm in Love with a Wonderful Murderer.
Doesn't have the same ring to it.
And then they thought that wasn't so good.
You know what?
So they changed it.
Better vowel.
Yeah, it's good. And now it can be sung universally. It doesn't have to be specific to that moment.
Sure. Put it in your cabaret. It'll be fine. You've heard the story, of course, of when Mary Martin first heard it, Richard Rodgers played on the piano, and she sang it and then fell off the piano bench.
Yes, and he said, I want you to do that.
Yeah. Don't ever
sing change
it differently.
That. Yes.
So sweet. The commanders have called Emile de Bac in to ask for his help in this mission that might turn the tides on the war in that area.
Yes.
And he says, I'm not going to because I'm in a relationship now.
Yes.
Which is interesting because the kids didn't come up.
Well, that brings me to an interesting point, because I remember you saying, like, think about maybe what your most or least favorite moments in the musical are. Mm-hmm. And it was a very specific sticking point that we discussed. The actor who played Emile had a really big problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, why is it that he is unwilling to help them out? Because he talks about Nellie and how he's in this relationship that and that's everything to him.
Yes,
and
it's the only thing.
Yes. And then flashing forward, as soon as that's not working, he's like, okay, I'll go.
Right.
And the actor, Robert Townsend, was saying, what about his kids?
Yeah.
As a father myself, I have a huge problem with this. It's a huge flaw in the writing.
Huge flaw.
Yeah. You know, so how do we talk through this? How do we... you know, make it so that maybe it's just a moment of such sadness that he acts on impulse to help Cable.
It's the last thing that just happened, so it's the one that's
I suppose, but that's the best we could do. Because it doesn't make any sense.
You're right.
Why he would leave his children.
Big flaw. Yeah. Big flaw. So he says no. Bloody Mary has, you know, sung about Ballyhie and has convinced Cable that this is some place that he'd like to visit. So Ballyhie it is.
Yes.
Now, the first notes of Ballyhie are very specifically taken from the pentatonic Eastern scale.
Yes.
Maybe that's what I should say. So like there's a very different kind of harmonic scale in Eastern music that Richard Rodgers was really trying
to
encapsulate. And it honestly becomes the motif for most of the score.
In fact, isn't that how the overture starts?
Starts.
Yep.
Yep. Very, very powerful three notes. So he goes to Ballyhie and meets Bloody Mary's daughter, Liat.
Yes.
They have some loving times.
Yes, they do.
Instantly, in fact.
Yes.
And she also doesn't speak because she doesn't speak English.
She can say a few words.
Yeah.
They try, but they can't.
Yeah, they try to communicate, but they're instead speaking the language of love.
And she sees a vulnerability in him, perhaps. Things he's seen, things he's been through already as a lieutenant, that pulls her into him. That's what we worked on. So it's not just like
that's
a lot.
It's another again problematic.
This would have happened back then. It's to Bloody Mary. This is maybe her daughter's way out of this life, but it's crude. It's kind of shocking. She's giving her daughter to a man.
That she doesn't know.
Correct. But he has all the right...
checks all the boxes.
To get her out.
Mm-hmm.
On
my mission, there were two attempts to get me to marry people on my mission.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Very serious ones.
Wow.
There was one woman who was married to another man. My missionary companion and I were teaching an English class, like a free English class. And she came and she gave us both Christmas cards. So we opened the cards and my mission companions, it just said like, Merry Christmas, love so-and-so. And then I opened mine and a whole page like fell out of the, you know, letter. And I was like, uh-oh, what is this? And it was this whole plan about the next English class that I come to, don't wear glasses. And then that will let me know that you're as in love with me as I am with you. And we'll run off together.
Did you know this person at all?
I mean, I had taught her English and we had also visited their home a couple times to say prayers and stuff. And I was freaked out. I was 19 years old, had, you know, certainly never dated girls.
Yeah.
And so I like called my mission president. I'm like, I don't know what to do. What do I do? Like, and he's like, it's okay. It's okay. You guys are very generous and you're in uniform and it can be confusing for people. And that's kind of where we left it. And so I just made sure to wear my glasses the next day.
Wow.
The next time.
That was your message.
Yeah. And I mean, I never saw her again. But
and isn't that interesting? Because I can't imagine what you just described.
Yeah.
And that's a world I don't know.
And it feels almost offensive to like share that experience, but it happened to me.
Yeah.
You know? And I certainly don't blame her. I had been to her home. It was not the dream.
Does that often happen mm-hmm. in the mission?
Wow. Yeah.
Wow.
You know, and you're sometimes in these areas and you represent, for better or worse, maybe because Americans are really good at advertising ourselves as the epitome of life, but you know, people buy it for whatever reason. And
isn't that interesting?
And it happens.
Wow.
So I wonder if on some level that's what is going on with Bloody Mary. You know, they're like she's buying into this package that cable exemplifies.
And America exemplified.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
So now it's Cable's turn to fall madly in love with someone, and he does.
Yes.
He's in love with Liat, sings another perfect song, Younger Than Springtime.
Perfect song.
And which...
How did these two songs come from the same musical?
Seriously.
Two of the most beautiful love songs ever.
I believe Younger Than Springtime was written for something else.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that.
And they were having a hard time finding a song, and they're like, well, what about this one? We had played with this melody, da-da-da-da, and then they wrote it, and it was perfect.
Wow, that's super cool, because yeah. It really fits that moment.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I did the show at Tuacon in southern Utah, and they turned Younger Than Springtime into, like, because you can flood the stage at Tuacon. They, yeah. like, turn on this river, and then, like, the water will rush over the stage. It's really impressive. Because it's outside in the canyon. And so there, when we were in Bali High, there were, like, a waterfall in the back of these red rocks was, like, going. And then the waterfall turns on, you know, full blast, and the water just drips down and comes and covers Liat and Cable. Like,
are you kidding me?
Like Eternity, or what's it called? From Here to Eternity.
Oh,
covers
right.
them, like, from, you know, From Here to Eternity with the water rushing over them. People lost their minds. Because the show can, I think, withstand a lot of texture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it is just about
it's
people.
Lush.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do they try to find a place for the river to flow in every show?
They sure do. I believe I believe there was a production of Fiddler on the Roof when Anna Tefka was flooded.
That makes me happy. So look at every show.
That was
Annie,
years ago.
Now, could the Hudson River...
They're like in their Hoovervilles being like, we'd like to thank you for really flooding us. Oh, my gosh.
Life is really bad. It just loses some of its luster.
And I think they have taken a break from it.
Smart.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to, you know.
You got to know your moments.
Exactly.
Like, every day's not Christmas.
Moments. Thank you. So now.
But back to South Pacific.
So now we're back to the plantation. There's this huge party that has just happened.
Yes.
And that is when Nellie learns about the kids.
Yes.
And that is the deal breaker. And she, in a very awkward moment, is like, oh, my gosh, I need to go. I'm so sorry. I'm so late. Da, da, da,
yep.
da. And he sings yet another reprise of Some Enchanted Evening.
Which
and
ends the act.
End of act one.
Yep.
Act two starts. Now it's Thanksgiving. Is it Thanksgiving? It's like a holiday.
The Thanksgiving follies.
Right.
Yep.
And they're doing this big folly show that the nurses are putting on to, you know, booster morale.
Yes.
Rodgers and Hammerstein and Joshua Logan specifically didn't want any choreography. They, you know, all of their shows at this point had had dream ballets and very specific dance numbers. But they wanted any and all of the dancing in South Pacific to feel just organic or real.
I love that.
Yeah.
We had choreography for the Thanksgiving Follies, but it was very, quote unquote, bad or simple.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
It was something that the nurses would have come up with themselves. It's not like...
It's not meant to be
the
impressive.
The whole show isn't about that. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a misconception sometimes when people come see it. They think they're going to come see some big splashy musical, and mm-hmm. it's the opposite of that. It's not big right. and splashy at all.
Yeah. If there are these moments, it's because they are part of the story.
Correct.
They have created this folly moment
right.
for that. Everybody is there. Then we kind of go backstage in a way, and we see mm-hmm. Cable with Liat and Bloody Mary, who are now all over on this island.
That's right.
And Bloody Mary sings Happy Talk, which is a cute little song. But
yes.
why does she? I'm not sure.
Now I have to remember.
Is it just more about like, here she is, you remember, you love her, take her to America?
Yes. She has an agenda.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, the way I approached it was not a cutesy number about the hands, but more about like how Liat's been taught to do a dance or a, you know, a hand dance, you know,
this
that
is almost
kind of thing.
Ritual.
Yes. So she nudges her to do it rather than it being all this, you know, happiness.
That's great. I love that. Unfortunately, Cable can't do it.
Mm-mm.
Here's another racist in the show.
Yeah. He is more evolved about it. I mean,
He's tortured about it.
Yeah.
For sure.
He says this isn't right. And he's the one who sings, you've got to be carefully taught.
Mm-hmm. He's looking at it from like a realistic place. What am I going to do when I bring this woman back?
But at the same time, he knows that it's wrong of him to feel this way. It just he can't push past it. Yeah.
I remember this is embarrassing to admit, but I remember going on a date with a boy and feeling that way.
Feeling that way about I can't push past this to like introduce this to my family or to
feeling like I hate how I am not with a girl right now because I would love to be looked at and regarded by society in a certain way.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Isn't that interesting?
Isn't that terrible?
Anytime.
And it's like, how unfair is that to my date?
Right.
Awful.
Well, I think that maybe the evolution of all of us as humans is to come to a place where it's not about perception. It's just about following truth and following
yep.
heart. And
amen.
Yeah. But it takes us all a while to get there in different
yeah.
ways. You know, like
everybody's on a journey.
We're all hitting a struggle. Yeah, exactly. when you say it's unfair to your date, of course, but it's also understandable with where you were at the time, what you'd been taught.
Right, right.
About what was proper or right and having to ask yourself bigger questions at a
yeah.
very young age, you know?
Yeah.
It's tough.
Yeah. Of course, Bloody Mary is horribly upset.
Yeah. She throws
his watch, right?
Yeah. Good for you.
Mm.
You've done your work.
I tried. After that, now Cable and Emile de Bec are both...
Loveless.
Yeah. And both kind of in a brokenhearted situation, but from opposite sides of it.
Right.
Where one is the...
The rejectee and one's
the
rejected.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. In this book, I found the original scene going into Carefully Taught.
Oh.
And it was between Nellie and Lieutenant Cable.
They do have a brief discussion in the... But is this something that was cut?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
So Cable's kind of taking out on Nellie his own self-hatred for having rejected Liat.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, damn it to hell, Cable shouts to Nellie. Why do you look so damned shocked? What's the difference if her hair is blonde and curly or black and straight? If I want her to be my wife, why can't I have her? You can, Nellie replies. It's just that people... I mean, they say it never works, don't they? They do, Cable answers in disgust, and then everybody does their damnedest to prove it. A hell of a chance Liat and I would have in one of those little gray stone and timber houses on the main line. Mr. and Mrs. Joseph Cable entertained last Tuesday with a housewarming. Nobody came.
Wow.
And then he went into Carefully Taught. And that was cut because they felt it was too much.
Too much for the time.
Yeah.
Maybe, instead, yeah. It's so interesting,
right?
though. Wow.
Instead, it now became between Cable and DeBeck.
Yeah.
Sharing their experience. Then I guess we can kind of fast forward to Emil DeBeck singing yet another perfect song.
This Nearly Was Mine.
I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it was interesting with, if I may, Robert Townsend played Emil in our production, and, you know, a finer actor there never was. He's just so talented in so many ways, and he's just also a glorious singer. To watch an actor just fill a song like that, that is just, it's very simple. There's not a lot going on, just his heart. Mm. And he, it was so compelling, I can't even tell you. I'm sure you can imagine.
I can imagine, yeah.
So those moments are just so amazing. Just sit back and go, good God, the talent that I get to work with sometimes. It's amazing.
Cool. That's so cool.
Yeah.
Okay, now Cable and DeBeck are on their mission,
yep.
Right? Because they have, Emil DeBeck, after knowing that Nellie's not a thing, has decided to go through with it.
Yep. He decides that in the scene. He says, I'm with you now.
All right, let's do
it. Let's go.
Now, it's a very intense action sequence, and the way that we as an audience experience it is through the radio.
Yep.
Now, during the mission, is it successful?
Yes, but...
However...
Cable
dies.
Dies.
Ooh, that's rough, actually.
Yeah, really hard. You hear the oncoming, you know, the enemy is approaching. Mm-hmm. You hear the shots. It then goes to, you know, that fuzz sound. Mm-hmm. And then you hear that he was killed.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Whew, I'm feeling that right now, mm-hmm. thinking about that. Sorry, Joe. I hope he learned some lessons, but man, yes. He was a tortured guy.
Yes, he was.
Emil comes back, though,
yes.
Alive, and he comes back to the plantation, and Nellie is there with the children.
Yes.
And there's the reprise of Dites Moi.
Yes. It should be mentioned that there's a beautiful moment on the beach where Nellie talks to Emil, but he's not there. She.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I don't remember this. Okay.
She just says, I was so foolish. You know, it's like her asking for forgiveness. And I think she sings the 15th reprise of Some Enchanted Evening at that point. Yeah. What she's saying, like, don't let him go. You know, never let him go. So she denounces her own way of thinking. And the next scene, you see her with the children. I don't know if we're supposed to believe that this is – that she has taken them in. You know, like, I mean, she's – caring for them or will in the future if Emil never comes back. I don't know.
She doesn't know if Emil's alive because – and nobody does, really.
Nope.
So I think
she's
she did
anyway.
I think she rushed to them
yeah.
in that moment.
So that's pretty cool. And then he appears.
And now there's a family.
And again, another very quiet moment at the end of the show. It's all without words. That they sit together as a family, and all they're doing is eating soup. And just in the front, Emil and Nellie reach across and join hands. And that's the end of the whole show.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's special.
It begins and ends quietly.
Yeah.
You know, but profoundly.
Incredibly profound.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
That's so great. Oh, wow. I so appreciate the standard and example of people like Oscar Hammerstein and all the creators of this show, and the work is not done. And I would I think that they would agree that we shouldn't just leave it to them to have solved everything because it's so not solved. We need to take it with us and now go forward and make it better and do more. And I think that's all we – that's all we can do.
Yes. These were the forward thinkers of their time, and their legacy is to hand that forward thinking to us at a different time and keep it pushing forward.
I remember this moment at my dinner table at my house when I was in high school. Maybe it wasn't high school. Maybe it was junior high. But it was when Martin Luther King Day became a holiday.
Oh.
And there were certain people in my family who didn't understand why.
Wow.
Because and I don't want to toot my own horn, but I like stood up and said why we needed this holiday. And
good for you.
And much to the credit of the elders of my family, They said, well, that's why the next generation will be better than we are.
Yeah.
And sometimes that takes some humility, right? And to be like, well, I did the best that I could, but it sure isn't good enough, and I hope the next generation will take it even further.
Yes. I think that that's what makes it interesting anyway, to look back at something like South Pacific and to see the protagonist, Nellie, facing her own demons.
Hmm.
That's a beautiful thing. And if we keep doing that, keep facing
our demons.
New demons, yeah. You know what I mean? With openness, love, acceptance, and an open mind to hear each other. You know, we don't condemn, but we try to understand where people came from and why their minds might be closed or tight, mm-hmm. according to what they were taught, and how do we open minds, mm-hmm. without talking hate to each other,
yeah.
and becoming so polarized that there's no discussion.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's wonderful that you brought that up with your family. You were brave enough to do it, mm-hmm. but they were brave enough to say, well, that's why your generation is going to be better than us.
Because they very well could have said, you don't know what you're talking about.
Of course they could. Of course.
Yeah.
So gives me hope. You
yeah,
know?
Exactly.
Those conversations give me hope.
And I think one of the real ways that we do it is through art, consuming it, creating it. And then having conversations afterward.
Yeah.
Because anybody who goes to South Pacific and expects escapism without conversation, I think isn't taking advantage of the piece that was created, you know?
And I think that's not why we do theater.
Yeah.
We want to put ourselves in an uncomfortable place so that we learn something and we go. I think some of the best things I see are the things that cause me it's a good discomfort because I mm-hmm. like that. You know, I don't shy away from it, but I think you make a good point. We don't go to feel comfortable.
Yeah, so. Even if it is the exhilaration of, I mean, because escapism can be thrilling.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and in a way that
fluff can be fun.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We just know when it's not fluffy. That's why it's so funny that I reacted to that costume piece with it was just going
right.
for yucks. It was like a vaudeville version
of South
Luther Billis's hard hat.
My
and I was
gosh,
like,
right.
not, no.
No, that's not.
That's not what's happening.
That's not the show.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you so much for
oh my
doing
gosh.
This.
It's
I had
my
such a
honor.
Wonderful time.
Me too.
Everybody, if you want to request a show that we do here on A Musical Theater Podcast, you can always email me at amusicalpodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Twitter at A Musical Podcast for more great content. Kirsten, how do we follow what you're up to? I mean, you're always directing stuff. Do you
yes.
have any projects that you want to talk about coming up?
Well, coming up for me next is Kismet at Musical,
oh, Musical
Theater
Guild.
Yes.
Wonderful.
So, yes, come see that. It's May 3rd,
oh,
right?
Oh, exciting. Yeah.
yeah.
This will be out by then.
So, oh, it will?
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
So, yeah, come see Kismet.
Fantastic.
Awesome.
All right, everybody, have a wonderful day. And I'm going to now close singing another reprise of Some Enchanted Evening.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.